The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. At a time when the world is spending more time than ever at home, there are serious concerns about an increase in domestic violence. Some preliminary reports are starting to come out and seem to bear this out. A report just 2 weeks ago from radiologists suggests an 80% increase in serious domestic injuries compared to the past 3 years. And even the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has made an appeal for peace in the home during the pandemic. My guest today has written a book that many are calling the definitive resource on domestic violence. Released last year, and now in softcover, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us, is now required reading for judges in a number of jurisdictions and a component in trainings for the NYPD. The author, journalist, and novelist Rachel Louise Snyder has been writing about domestic violence for a number of years in publications like The New Yorker, New York Times Magazine, New Republic, and Atlantic, among others. No Visible Bruises was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction, named one of the best books of the year by a host of publications for its work at dispelling myths and misconceptions surrounding domestic violence. Snyder is a professor of creative writing and journalism at American University, and my guest today on Studio Tulsa as we talk about her book, No Visible Bruises. Rachel Louise Snyder, thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Your book, No Visible Bruises, is a powerful read about domestic violence, which accounts for at least 15% of all violent crime in America. And that number seems incredibly low when you consider all the calls that police receive in big cities and some of the things that you write about in this book. And you wrote that you wanted to answer three essential questions about domestic violence. What were those questions?
Well, the book is divided into three segments or three parts. And so each part had a kind of driving question. The first one was, why doesn't she just leave, right? That's the number one question asked. And it's in some ways just the wrong question to be asking. So I tried to lay out like why that is, A, why victims don't leave, but also why it's an unreasonable question to ask. The second question is, can someone who is violent truly become nonviolent? And what does that look like? So, you know, I spent a lot of time with convicted abusers trying to answer that question. And then the third question really was, why does it matter? What's being done about it and why does it matter? And in some ways, that is the most interesting one because, you know, I've had people say to me, well, domestic violence, yeah, I'm sure it's a necessary book, but I'm not really interested in that, you know, or I don't have any experience with that. And so I lay out why it matters or should matter to everyone, whether you're standing at the, you know, the receiving end of a punch or not.
Well, let's start there. Why does it matter? And the other thing which we get in is this is not just about 15% of all violent crime in America. It underpins so much of violent crime in America.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you answered the question. I mean, that really is truly it. It's that domestic violence is like the entree into violence. I mean, people who join gangs almost always have an introduction to violence first in their own home. One example, right? The leading cause of homelessness for women in America today is domestic violence. Mass shootings, there's been a correlation between mass shootings and domestic violence, but the correlation is actually multi-pronged, if you will. It's not just that mass shooters often have, you know, often are abusers themselves. That's certainly been true. But many of them, someone like Omar Mateen, for example, the Orlando Pulse shooting, you know, some folks suggest that his father was abusive. But even putting that aside, he was terribly abusive to both his first and second wife. In fact, his first wife he had strangled, which is a felony in nearly every state in this country. And he should have been behind bars. But he wasn't. In fact, he was never even charged. So, you know, there's a way in which domestic violence, not treating domestic violence or addressing it, underscores so many of the social and criminal issues that we face in this country today. And that's not even getting into the, you know, billions of dollars we spend in healthcare and court costs and, you know, shelters, right, and things like that. So it's also just a huge industry.
It's interesting on the mass shooting subject that we often think of the final act of, you know, it's a post office, it's a school, but oftentimes that event, that final event began at the home,
right,
and then moved out of the home into the public square in some sort.
Yeah. I mean, certainly Newtown was an example of that. Sutherland Springs was an example of that. Even going all the way back to the 60s with the first mass shooting at the University of Texas. You know, Charles Whitman started the night before by killing his wife and his mother. And then the next day went on to kill all those students. So, you know, we are paying the price of not taking domestic violence seriously in all these other arenas.
In the book, you share the story of Michelle Monson Mosier, a young Montana mother. She and her two children, Kyle and Christy, were murdered by their father and husband, Rocky, in November 2001. At the time, it shocked the state of Montana. As you write, it still haunts the people involved and not so involved. I mean, you know, DAs that weren't even DAs at the time. It haunts them to this day. Why was it important to tell readers this particular story? Was it a typical story of domestic violence or atypical in some way?
It was a little bit of both, actually. It was very typical in that no one outside her immediate home knew that there was any abuse at all. They had heard verbal abuse, but they had never seen evidence of physical abuse. And this is so common with domestic violence. And he had a lot of control over her. He wouldn't let her work outside the house. He wouldn't let her have friends over. He said that, you know, they were a bad influence on the kids. He wouldn't let her wear makeup. He wouldn't let her take prescription medication if it was not approved by him in advance. At one point, right before he killed them all, he even went and got a rattlesnake in the outskirts of Billings, Montana, and brought it home and kept it in a cage. And he would tell her, I'm going to put this in bed with you if you do anything I don't like. And in that kind of instance, you know, you don't need any physical abuse at all to have absolute control. Just think of how terrifying that would be, just the anxiety. And so her story really was an intersection of all the forces in a sort of typical domestic violence situation, meaning the ways in which the system, when she finally brought the system in, failed her, the ways in which she felt too much shame for being a victim and didn't want anybody to know, the ways in which, you know, society tells us that in many ways, anyway, that women are subservient to men, and she certainly believed that to some extent. And then also her case was atypical because after the incident happened, the state of Montana said this is absolutely unacceptable, and they used her case in what is called a fatality review to try to figure out ways where the system could have intervened and failed her in some way. So it was very typical, her case was, for domestic violence. And, you know, her mother, even her husband's mother, both of them, their names are Sally and Sarah, are really, really motivated to not have other families go through this. And the pain almost 20 years later is just palpable with both of them. And it didn't need to happen.
Of course, you used this story as an illustration for that first segment of the book of why, again, this wrong question of why victims stay. Michelle was not planning on staying. She was working out a plan to leave. It looks like, right, in hindsight, that she was, right, taking nursing classes. You know, she married Rocky and had their first child when she was 16 and 17. The two kids came. And she's, you know, 7 years in. And she's developing a plan to leave, but, you know, the system failed her when she did go out, reached out to the system. And this is something I wanted to talk about, was her deciding to leave and making these plans. Did it escalate the violence within the household? And does it?
Oh,
can
yeah.
it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It does. It can. I mean, there's a lot of research that says the most dangerous time for any victim is when they go to leave. But the danger doesn't remain eternal necessarily, right? The danger doesn't remain high for the rest of your life. It usually drops off after a year or two. And, you know, there's a negotiation that can happen. But she was doing everything to try to leave that she could without his knowing. So she had, in addition to taking college courses in nursing, and, you know, one of the amazing things about her is that she had two kids by the time she was 18 years old, under the age of three, and she still graduated high school on time. Like, what has the world missed by her death? What have we missed in an incredible human full of potential? So she had a long view. She had put the house in her name, a house that they lived in that was owned by her father, secretly, so she could get him out someday. The husband, his name is Rocky. She was getting her nursing degree so that she could, you know, afford to raise the kids on her own without Rocky's money. I mean, you know, she had gone to her mother's house. She had gone to her father's house. But, you know, in some ways, our system makes it impossible for women, especially women with kids. You know, what's she going to do? Like, move three states away? You can't enroll your children without both parents' signatures, right? I mean, you can't just take your kids entirely off the grid without somebody coming after you. And she would say to her sister, you know, where in the world am I going to go that he's not going to find me? And she was right. She knew what she was up against. She knew he was dangerous.
There was one moment where she decided to file a protective order. She files a protective order. He's put into custody. It's a misdemeanor, but she recants. And this is a very common story, unfortunately all too common, that,
yeah.
And as you write in the book, you said this was this decision of survival. Recanting the story was perhaps more plausible for survival of the family than keeping it in place, him being able to get out, and not knowing what the consequences of that decision would be.
Yeah, yeah. It's so important. And, you know, one of the things I tried to do in the book was not just offer stories of the ways in which we all fail all the time, but solutions that so many areas have come up with, and Montana is one of them. So, you know, to understand why she recants, you have to understand the message that she received. She went, she filed a restraining order, he was arrested, he was taken to jail, and he was there for maybe an hour, maybe 45 minutes, and the judge allowed his parents to bail him out. He called his parents. He's a great manipulator, as most abusers are. And he made promises. Oh, I shouldn't have done that. I went too far. I promise we're going to work it out. A father has a right to be with his children. What's she going to do? Send me to jail and not let me see my kids, right? All those things are terrible. And so his parents bail him out and then call her up and say, sweetie, we just talked to Rocky. He is so remorseful and embarrassed. He feels terrible. We bailed him out. We've taken him to his brother's house. He promises that he's going to, you know, go to therapy with you or get help or whatever. The message that she gets from that is that she brought the system in, he was arrested, and the system immediately failed to hold him. He is more powerful than the system, right? That's the sort of underlying subconscious message that a victim receives. And she immediately turned around and went back into the DA's office and recanted and said, there is no snake. I made it all up. You know, leave us alone. Just leave my family alone. It's our problem. We'll take care of it. She was doing everything she could to show him her loyalty so that he would not get more dangerous. That's the sort of psychological series of steps there. What Montana did, one of the many things that they've changed is that if someone is arrested for domestic violence, even a misdemeanor, you know, like even a low level misdemeanor, they are not allowed to bail out until they see a judge, and they are not, in with domestic violence, they are not allowed to see a judge until after lunch. So they're basically held for three or four extra hours. And here's what that does. That little thing that costs communities almost nothing means that an advocate could have gone to Michelle's house, met with Michelle, given her a danger assessment of the 20 highest risk indicators, figured out what level of danger Michelle was in, either packed her up and gotten her to a shelter or changed the locks on her house, installed security cameras. They also have a restraining orders that are the size of driver's licenses and are laminated. And victims like Michelle can get 20 of those now, so they can pass them out to neighbors or friends or teachers at her kid's school or whoever needs to know that this guy is not allowed around. Because the night she was killed, a neighbor saw him peeking in the windows of his house. Mm. But because she didn't know there was an active restraining order against him, she didn't call the police. So, you know, so that's the kind of basic narrative of where we failed and what we can do better and why victims do what they do.
I was struck by something, the way you wrote it in the book. You said the system often sends the signal that the perpetrator's freedom is more important than the victim's safety.
Exactly. And her story is the perfect illustration of that, but you see it over and over and over.
My guest today is Rachel Louise Snyder, journalist and novelist. She's an associate professor of creative writing and journalism at American University. Her book, which was first published last year, was one of the most important books we've seen in a number of years on domestic violence. It's titled No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. And it's now out in softcover. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. We talked about the domestic violence danger assessment. And you spend quite a bit of time in the book talking about this assessment. This assessment has been honed over a number of years, and it really gives people within the system, advocates, a good sense of what is actually happening in the home. Tell us a little bit about this assessment.
Sure. I mean, it was created by a woman, a nurse, who really had intended it to be used in emergency rooms, right? Because emergency rooms often are the first place a victim will seek help, long before a domestic violence agency or advocate is called. Jacqueline Campbell is her name. She's a professor at Johns Hopkins. And so she did research to try to determine if there was some way we could look at what the highest risk indicators were for domestic violence homicide. So there's 20 items on the danger assessment. They're weighted. So the first question is the most important. The 20th question is, you know, least important. And the top questions are things like, you know, prior incidents of domestic violence is, you know, number one, strangulation or choking, non-fatal strangulation or choking, which is very often the penultimate act before a homicide. She looks at things like, you know, access to a gun. Those are all in the top five, just those three things. And she does a weighted score. And so I did a danger assessment on Michelle, a posthumous danger assessment. There are two questions that I couldn't answer because she is not with us anymore. And they are things like, you know, did he ever force you to have sex against your will? Essentially is one of them. And I can't quite remember the other one. But she scored an 18. It's about as high as you can get. You know, what you do with that score is you can figure out where the most dangerous victims need interventions and create a series of interventions around them. I wrote about this first in the New Yorker a long time ago, 2013, I think it was. And, you know, anybody can look up the danger assessment. If you have a friend that you're worried about, you can go to dangerassessment.org, and you won't have the training on how to weight the questions, but you can at least say, look, I know that seven of these things have happened in your home. Like, you need to take this seriously.
Yeah. You've mentioned the choking question, and you spend some time in the book talking about this as, and you refer to it just now as the penultimate act towards taking, you know, a family member's life. If that's ever happened in your life, how important is it for someone to be seeking help?
It is, I would say, no matter what the circumstances are, that you need to seek help for that. You know, the problem with strangulation is that we have such ad hoc training when it comes to folks who do intervention. Most domestic violence advocates these days know about the seriousness of choking or strangulation. And the East Coast, by the way, interestingly, calls it choking, and the West Coast calls it strangulation. It's funny, the language between the two. But our police are so often not trained on how to identify strangulation, particularly because only about 15% of non-fatal strangulation injuries are visible. So they don't have the forensic cameras, for example, to look at bruising under the skin, especially if you're darker skinned. If you're Black or you're Native American or, you know, you're brown skinned, you especially need those cameras. They don't know to look for petechiae, for example, which is, you know, red bloodshot eyes, or sometimes it appears around the scalp. They don't know to look for urination and defecation. And victims won't come forward if that has happened to them because it's embarrassing. But that is a sign that you are a second away from death. And if it's not uncommon for a choking victim to not remember or recall how she was on one side of the room and got to the other, right? She may not even know that she passed out for a couple of seconds. So all these things are really important for first responders to know and understand. You know, when I first read about the George Floyd homicide, one of the things that really struck out to me was the fact that he urinated on himself. I mean, that is, if that officer had been trained, right, if any of those four officers had been trained, that would have been a signal, hey, we're killing this guy.
Unfortunately, I have a feeling that in so many circumstances, it would be laughter. He's peeing on himself.
Right.
You know.
Right.
My guest today is Rachel Louise Snyder. Her new book is No Visible Bruises. It actually came out last year. It's now out in softcover. What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. You mentioned George Floyd. I have to say, you know, the pandemic had to have an effect on the state of private violence in our country right now. Is there any sense that we know what's happening in homes now?
Well, there have been a couple of articles, and there's at least one report that is now out. The articles that I've read suggest that it's increased exponentially. This one article, this is one research report, which was more scientific than newspaper articles, suggested that we just simply didn't quite know yet, because we're just still in the middle of it. But I will say that homicide levels are up everywhere. I mean, Milwaukee, I did a story for the New Yorker on COVID and domestic violence recently, a month or two ago. And I interviewed the DA in Milwaukee, and by the end of May, they had 52 homicides. Normally, they have about 24 at that time, so more than double. Now, not all of those, obviously, are domestic violence homicides, but many of them are. And so we're not going to have we don't have the homicide numbers for 2020 until about the fall of 2021. But I expect they're going to be absolutely chilling. You know, what I'm seeing is that people are not calling 911 as often, or they're not calling domestic violence hotlines as often, but when they do call, it's much more serious and it's much more violent.
You know, part of your book is about seeing how people are trying to make a difference. You talked about how Montana changed up their procedures in the wake of this murder now 19 years ago, practically. And can you give us a sense of how much more serious law enforcement advocacy groups are taking, you know, maybe some of those beginning steps of domestic violence in intervening in the home situation?
I mean, it really is jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and it depends to a large extent on who is at the top and what their priorities are, you know, the elected sheriffs in any given jurisdiction. What I see is that the jurisdictions that have made the most progress in addressing domestic violence are those that work together across bureaucracy. So where the advocates and the police officers and the DAs all know each other. One of the, I think, more effective changes that we've seen in recent years is with what we call high-risk teams. And those are teams who have, it was a project created in Massachusetts around 2005, somewhere around there. And they take the danger assessment, they do a danger assessment on a victim, they try to determine the level of dangerousness, and then based on the score, they build protections around the victim. So they might do things like install security cameras, change locks, get someone into shelter, ask the police for extra drive-bys, hold someone, if that state allows it, on dangerousness pre-trial. There's all kinds of things that happen when high-risk teams work together. And these teams, I've seen them, you know, from coast to coast in this country, consist of representatives from obviously the DV agencies and police departments, but also probation and parole and batterers and intervention and hospital representatives, sometimes a clergy member. Victims often seek out help from clergy before they call a DV agency. And they meet, you know, usually monthly and talk about cases they have that are coming up or pending or changes to a case that might be ongoing where they need to, you know, someone's going to go to court soon and so they for custody and so they know that it's a very dangerous time. So they build an extra protection. So and all that takes is communication, right? It's free. Communication, I would say, and an open mind to problem solving.
Well, it's interesting. You know, you're right. It says, you know, not the answer is not to lock up more abusers, you know, put them away. It's to break whatever cycle that they've gone through, because most of them have gone through a cycle themselves.
Yeah. You know, one of the amazing things that we've learned during COVID is that abuser intervention programs, or batterers intervention, as they're sometimes called, all had to go online to Zoom. And the assumption was that these guys were just going to stop showing up, right? They're court ordered to be there most of the time. They don't want to be there. They're not going to show up. And they couldn't make them mandatory once they went online, because you can't mandate that someone has internet at their home if they can't afford it, or that they increase their minutes on their phone if they're, you know, if they don't have the money or whatever. So they not only went online, but they, most of them became voluntary. And what they have found is that 80% of these guys still show up. They still show up. This flies in the face of what we all assume about a violent person, that person does not want to not be violent. You know, it's really important going forward that we take that knowledge into whatever we plan post-COVID. You know, we cannot arrest our way out of this situation. No one ever came out of jail or prison less violent, right? So I'm always saying, like, look, let's take the shelter system that we have in place in this country. We are 2,000 plus shelters, they're phenomenal shelters. But let's put the perpetrators in the shelter and keep the victims and the kids in their home so they don't have to be the ones to leave. And, you know, I sort of laugh at that, and I'm not the originator of that idea, but there's something brilliant about that, about saying, like, you can still be part of the economic life of this country. You can go to your job every day, but you're going to live in this house for 4 months or 6 months or however long it takes, and we're going to have interventions. We're going to do abuser intervention classes. We're going to have, you know, drug or alcohol counseling. We might have group or individual counseling, whatever it is. You know, this has been going on in Israel for 20 years. And I was supposed to report on it before COVID, but I obviously can't travel to Israel right now. But to me, that is a really innovative idea that we're not utilizing. I mean, we have to have more choices than just prison or scot-free.
The name of the book is No Visible Bruises. Rachel, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it very much.
It's been my pleasure, Rich. Thank you.
Rachel Louise Snyder is a journalist and novelist and an associate professor of creative writing and journalism at American University. Her 2019 book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us, was one of the most critically acclaimed and important books of 2019. It's now out in softcover from Bloomsbury. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence and needs help and resources, there is help available near you. Call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 800-799-SAFE. They can put you in touch with local resources that can help you. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.